Today is, of course, Tu B'Shvat, and the sun is shining to remind us that the spring is not far away, although hopefully there's a bit more winter yet to come. And the OU Israel Center asked that all the shirim today be themed in some way around Tu B'Shvat Eretz Yisrael. I know that Rabbi Adler spoke on Eretz Yisrael. I'd like to speak about a topic that actually we've never really raised here before, which is the question of climate change and environmentalism. Now, for some people, this is a bit of a tired topic. They're not really that interested in hearing even more about these issues. But I think it deserves one shear, at least, because I think this is something which surrounds us, this discussion surrounds us, and we need to have a few Torah perspectives on that as well. I'm by no means the first person to give shirim on this issue. There are some good shirim online. I even mentioned someone in the footnotes as well. And you can find those if you go follow those links. Just looking ahead a little bit, I'd like to actually move over the next few weeks, please God, into a completely different area, which is another area that we haven't really discussed. I'd like to do a series on halacha, hashkafa, and technology, certain issues that have changed in technology. There are many issues, driverless cars and all sorts of things which are changing all around us, which raise very interesting halachic questions and indeed hashkafic questions, and there's a lot for us to talk about. So let's talk for a few weeks about science, Torah, Chazal, technology. Hopefully we'll have some very fascinating discussions. But for today, we're in climate change. Let's start with a few introductory issues, because there's a lot of sources to get through, and I want to make sure we have time. First of all, I think it's fair to say, I'm not a climatologist and I am not a scientist, but this seems to be a real issue. I brought you just a very quick introductory piece from an American climate choice panel discussion. There is a strong, credible body of evidence based on multiple lines of research documenting the climate is changing and that these changes are in large part caused by human activities. Whilst much remains to be learned, the core phenomenon, scientific questions and hypotheses have been examined thoroughly and have stood firm in the face of serious scientific debate and careful evaluation of the alternative explanations. Some scientific conclusions or theories have been so thoroughly examined and tested and supported by so many independent observations and results that the likelihood of subsequently being found to be wrong is vanishingly small. Such conclusions and theories are then regarded as settled facts. This is the case for conclusions that the Earth system is warming and that much of this warming is very likely due to human activity. Now, I know that there are lots of skeptics, or there are some skeptics on these issues, and it's not for me to express a view one way or the other, but most of the scientific community seems pretty clear that A, things are warming up, which has implications across the planet, and B, that some of that, at least, maybe even much of that, is due to our own activities on this planet. So let's take that as a given for now, even though we'll see that there are problems with that particular approach. Leaving aside the issue of local pollution dangers, which have been around for centuries, oil spills, smoke pollution, chemical dumping, ozone depletion, gas leaks, nuclear fallout, etc., etc., makes you want to basically crawl up and go back to bed, crawl into bed and just ignore the situation, but you can't do that. All of this raises a question as to what are we meant to think, and then what are we meant to do about this? On the other side, I think there is a problem that we have, which is that climate change and environmentalism is almost becoming a secular religion, which is the heating on in here, by the way? Do you think the heating needs to be on? No. Can we ask someone please to turn the heating off, otherwise we're all going to roast before too long or fall asleep. My job is to help you stop falling asleep, but unless of course you want to fall asleep, in which case I'm happy to help you fall asleep. Let me read you a piece by Michael Crichton. Michael Crichton was, of course, an author. He passed away some years ago, and he's by no means, yes, Jurassic Park was one of his pieces. He's by no means an expert on climate change, but he said something, and he said it very well in number two. This is a speech he gave 15 years ago. He says, today one of the most powerful religions in the Western world is environmentalism. Environmentalism seems to be the religion of choice for urban atheists. Why do I say it's a religion? Well, just look at the beliefs. If you look carefully, you'll see that environmentalism is, in fact, a perfect 21st century remapping of traditional Judeo-Christian beliefs and myths. There's an initial Eden, a paradise, a state of grace and a unity with nature. There's a fall from grace into a state of pollution as a result of eating from the tree of knowledge. And as a result of our actions, there's a judgment day coming for us all. We are all energy sinners, doomed to die unless we seek salvation, which is now called sustainability. Sustainability is salvation in the church of the environment. Just as organic food is its communion, the pesticide-free wafer is that the right people with the right beliefs imbibe. Eden, the fall of man, the loss of grace, the coming doomsday, these are deeply held mythic structures. They are profoundly conservative beliefs. They may even be hardwired into the brain, for all I know. I certainly don't want to talk anybody out of them. But the reason I don't want to talk anybody out of these beliefs is I know that I can't talk anybody out of them. These are not facts that can be argued. These are issues of faith. And so it is sadly with environmentalism. Increasingly, it seems that facts are necessary because the tenets of environmentalism are all about belief. It's about whether you are going to be a sinner or saved, whether you're going to be one of the people on the side of salvation or on the side of doom, whether you're going to be one of us or one of them. And I think that's a very well-made point. Now, I'm not suggesting that what I said in the first source is not still the case. And indeed, I found a very interesting short piece from the New Atlantis on this. And number three, describing environmentalism as a religion is not equivalent to saying that global warming is not real. Indeed, the evidence for it is overwhelming, and there are powerful reasons to believe that humans are causing it. But no matter its empirical basis, environmental is progressively taking the social form of a religion and fulfilling some of the individual needs associated with religion with major political and policy implications. And I personally feel that is very true, meaning even if all the facts are substantiable and that there is global warming which needs to be dealt with, the way people are beginning to relate to it, or maybe have been for some time, is almost like a religious issue. The Pope has said that there are new sins, environmental sins. He's added that to the list of sins. I'm not here to give you an understanding of Catholic theology. You can take that up with your local Orthodox Catholic priest. But there definitely seems to be a religious perspective to this. People recycle. We recycle. It's really an article of faith almost. I have no idea, honestly, whether it makes any difference to anything. I either believe it or I don't believe it, meaning I'm not here to be a skeptic and I'm not here to be a devotee, but I really don't know. You know, I put this in this box and this in that box and I assume that somebody does something with it which makes a difference somewhere, maybe, somehow. And it really is almost like a belief system because people have told me that it will work that way. But that's not to say that we don't have our own perspective on it, and we do, and I think we need to look at this very carefully. One of the questions that I want to raise, which will get us into our own perspective, is who's to blame for this? And there is a feeling out there that in some sense we're to blame, meaning the religious people are part of the problem and not part of the solution. Let me bring you this op-ed from the New York Times in 1970. Here, looking number four. A group of Protestant theologians asserted here today that Christianity has played its part in provoking the current environmental crisis, and that any solution to it would require major modification of current social and religious values, which means you solve the environmental problem by changing the way that people understand their religious beliefs. Among the values to come under attack were the rights of couples to have large families. That's what's creating part of the problem, too many people having too many children. The need for constant expanding economy and the sacredness of human life over and against the rest of nature. Meaning one of the problems is that we regard human life as more important than non-human life. That's the problem, it says here. Among the values to come under attack, the theologians, 20 in number, were participants in a three-day conference on the theology of survival, which ended today at the School of Theology in Claremont. It was the first major symposium to be convened to consider the religious dimensions of the ecological issue. Virtually all the scholars agreed that the traditional Christian attitude towards nature has given sanction to exploitation of the environment by science and technology, and thus contributed to air and water pollution, overpopulation, and other ecological threats. Basic to this assertion is the commandment in Genesis 1:28, for man to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over every other living thing, etc. In a well-known article in a science magazine, a professor of history at the University of California argued that this idea, coupled with the Judeo-Christian rejection of pagan beliefs in the divinity of nature made it possible for the Western society to exploit nature in the mood of indifference to the feelings of natural objects. You hear what's going on here? This is a very interesting piece. Basically, the Bible, the Torah, yeah, is part of the problem because this is causing us not to realize that actually pagan beliefs have value. Pagan beliefs respect the animal kingdom, and the animal feelings and the feelings of non-human objects have to be taken into account in a way that religious people classically in the Judeo-Christian tradition do not. The theologians also agreed that for several centuries, theology like Western theology has gone too far in making man the center of attention. John B. Cobb, Jr., a professor at Claremont, who is regarded as a major American theologian, asserted this trend began with Descartes, who made human thought the starting point of philosophy, and that its effect has been to reduce love of the subhuman world to sentimentality. This is a very interesting piece, and I think it speaks volumes, because I, from my discussions with people, I think quite a lot of people feel this, in some sense, that it's classic religion that somehow has given rise to this this abuse of the environment. Now, obviously, this article produced a backlash, produced a number of articles against it. Heschel, I brought you, he actually wrote this in 1959, but he says, actually, the desanctification of nature. Look at what he says here. One of the great achievements of the prophets, his PhD thesis originally was on the prophets, Rabbi Heschel, was the repudiation of nature as an object of adoration. They tried to teach us that neither nature's beauty nor grandeur, neither power nor the state, neither money nor things or space are worth our supreme adoration, love, sacrifice, or self-dedication. Yet, the desanctification of nature did not in any way bring about an alienation of nature. It brought man together with all things in a fellowship of praise. Biblical man could say that he was in league with the stones of the field. So Heschel wants to say there that yes, we desanctified nature. We pulled away from a pagan attitude to nature, but that doesn't mean that we reject nature. That the two shouldn't be connected with each other. You don't have to be a pagan. You don't have to be a tree hugger to be a tree lover. Okay, that's not his line, and I don't even know if it's a good line. Rabbi Lamb came out very clearly in a very nice, pithy statement in number 6, Rabbi Norman Lamb, to appeal to contemporary man to revert in this 20th century to a pagan-like nature worship in order to restrain technology from further encroachment and devastation of the resources of nature is a piece of atavistic nonsense. He doesn't like it, and I don't blame him. So, is there a Jewish position? People think that there is a Jewish position and maybe we're part of the problem. Are we part of the problem or are we part of the solution or do we really not deal with it? So, in the last little bit of introduction, I brought you a small piece by Hillel Halkin. Hillel Halkin is an author, a translator, a commentator who writes for Israeli publications. And he says an interesting thing here, and I want to just test whether he's right or wrong. He says, but there's a big difference between trying to make Judaism relevant to contemporary problems and trying to turn it into a reflection of contemporary attitudes. Meaning, he wants to ask, is there really a Jewish position on environmentalism? Or are we just trying to recreate Torah ideas in modern sensitivities and sensibilities? And it's the latter of these two activities that eco-Judaism is engaged in. As such, it's really, he says, like many other kinds of modern Judaism before it, starting with the Reform movement in 19th century Germany, more of an eco-Judaism than an eco-Judaism. I'd like to propose a simple test to determine if eco-Judaism is a natural outgrowth of Jewish theology and thought. Suppose you're not already an environmentalist. Would a knowledge of rabbinic Jewish texts and traditions turn you into one? And he answers, the answer, of course, is no. The fact is that rabbinic Judaism traditionally has had very little to say about environmental problems, for the simple reason that Jews have lived for the better part of their history in the diaspora, and the diaspora was never considered by them to be their true environment. The rabbis thought about many things, but the environment, in the sense in which the word is now used, was never one of them. So he wants to argue that, come on, you're just really trying to read things in. We don't really have a position on environmentalism. Now, statements like that are very interesting because in one paragraph, he speaks for all of rabbinic thought and all of rabbinic Judaism. That's a very broad and brave statement to make, to say that you have been through the whole rabbinic literature and there really is nothing about environmentalism. And I think it is true to say that the way we now perceive environmentalism perhaps is different than the way it was perceived in the past, but I think it's not true to say that we do not have a rich tradition that warns us against damaging the environment, and indeed halachically as well as hashgafically, exhorts us to make sure that we don't do that and to take care of the world around us. And what I want to show you is that there are really three models in classic Jewish thought that take us to a position which has a sensitivity to the environment. Those three models really are the initial creation of mankind and the relationship that mankind has with the world around them, as Adam HaRishon in Gan Eden, La'avda Olashamra, we'll talk about that. Model two is Bal Tashchis, which we've never really talked about in this forum, which is the mitzvah not to destroy things around us unnecessarily. And the third one is the halachic system of Hilchot Shcheinim, and damages, and public nuisance, and the halachas which regulate and restrict what we can do for our own private gain if it's going to affect other people's enjoyment of their world and their life. So those three models, there may indeed be more, but I certainly don't have time for more today. I'd like to examine those three in the 45 minutes that we have and have a look a little bit at how that works. Let's start off with the basic model of what is the relationship between mankind and the natural world. And we looked a little bit at this when we talked about pets. Remember, we talked about Tsar Bali Chaim and such like some time ago. I don't remember who was here, or if they were here, who remembers what we did when, okay? Some people have very long memories, some people can't remember what happened 15 minutes ago. So we talked a little bit about that. But this is a little bit different. And we saw already from that op-ed from the New York Times, this is the thing that they fixated on and accused us of. So let's have a look at what actually happens. It's not clear that there is a Judeo-Christian heritage to this. There's a Jewish position and there's a Christian position. And it's perhaps a little bit sometimes inaccurate to conflate them just as a Judeo-Christian position, as if we say the same things about everything. Let's look at the actual sources. Number 8. Vayivra Elokim es ha'adam b'tzalmo. Mankind is made in the in the image of God, obviously not a physical image, but in terms of thought and understanding and moral choice. But Tzelem Elokim bara oto, zachar v'kneva bara otam. Fine, man and woman created in the image of God. Vayivarech otam Elokim. So God gives them a bracha. Vayomer lehem Elokim pru uvu, go and spread around the world. Milu et ha'as. Right. Clearly, the other animals in many respects. That puts between human life and animal life. Does the human life come first? Does the animal life come first? And I'm not talking about morally desensitized people. I'm talking about professors of bioethics around the world. This is a real debate. We always follow that position. However, what they did not quote in that op-ed from the Times is the next pasuk, number 9, that this responsibility or this position of power comes with responsibility. Vayita Hashem kim gan Eden mikedem. Okay, so God plants a garden east of Eden. Vayasem sham et ha'adam asher yatsa. And he puts the mankind that he, the man that he created, into that garden. Vayikach Hashem Elokim et ha'adam v'yinachehu b'gan Eden. God puts man in Gan Eden la'avda shamra. Very important words. To work the garden, he is an oved. He serves the garden. He serves the environment u'lishamra. And he protects the environment. It's a very different perspective. You can go back, of course, to Rav Soloveitchik in The Lowly Man of Faith. Adam 1, Adam 2, that we have these two, if you like, understandings of the world. There's Adam 1, who is l'kivshuha, redu et ha'aretz v'kivshuha, go and subdue the world, and technology is central to the human condition. And there's Adam 2, which is, no, you are part of a bigger environment. You serve that environment, not serve in a kind of divinity sense, but you work for that, and you protect that. Okay, you have to eat from this, and if you want to eat from this, you have to protect it. The order is very important. If you want to be able to eat from the garden, you have to be able to protect the garden. I want to pick up a beautiful piece in Koheles Rabbah in number 10, which is there's going to be a lot of very nice midrashim, very beautiful midrashim on this issue we're going to see today. There's a pasuk in Koheles in Perek Zayin. It says, Re'eit Masa Elokim. See how what God made. Ki mi yachol etaken et asher ivto. Who can fix what has been twisted? So what does that pasuk mean? So says the midrash, b'shah shebara kodesh baruch hu et ha'adam harishon. When God created mankind, natlover ziru al kol ilanei gan Eden. This is why it's nice for Tzu B'Shvat. God took Adam around all the trees in Gan Eden. Va'amoloi, and he said, re'ei ma'asai, look at what I've made. Kama na'im u'mushubachim hem. Look how beautiful they are. Look how worthy of praise they are. Kol ma shebarati b'shvilcha barati. I've made all this for you. Tein datcha shelo tekalkel. Make sure that you don't ruin it. Don't destroy my world. Because if you mess it up, no one's going to fix it after you. It's your world. I'm not going to come back and recreate it. And, you know, this, if anything, is a clear statement that Chazal are very focused on the fact that we have a responsibility in this world not to destroy it. And if we destroy it, we do not have another world to go to. There are many mitzvot that reflect this. Shabbat, Rabbi Grunfeld, who has a very, very famous work called The Sabbath, he says that you can read in your own time in number 11, keeping Shabbos, the idea of not working one day a week, is a weekly confirmation of this idea that that we live in the world and we mustn't destroy the world and corrupt the world. And he says when we keep Shabbat, we have to keep this in mind as well. Just go over the page. Shemitah and Yovel. Obvious, I don't need to go into details on that. The idea of the Pasuk of Shemitah number 12, Haaretz lo timakel litzmitut. You cannot be an owner in the land. You cannot sell the land permanently. Why? Ki li haaretz. The land doesn't belong to you. The land belongs to me, says God. Ki gerim v'toshavim atem imadi. You are just temporary renters. You are just letting, you are here for a little while and you're moving on. But the land belongs to God. Very important. Something that's perhaps less focused on is the mitzvah not to cause any species to become extinct. Number 13, Shol oseh oto ve'et beno lo tishchatu b'yom echad. You may not kill an animal and its child. This is a kosher animal, things that you are allowed to kill. Shechita, that you are allowed to do. You may not kill the mother and the child on the same day. So too, you must shoo away the mother bird before you take the chicks or the eggs. And the Ramban connects these two mitzvot. Look at number 15. Kira kan sipor lefanecha. Gam zo mitzvah mo'eret min otova edmono. Lo tishchatu biyom echad. This mitzvah of shooing away the mother bird can be understood through the prism of the mitzvah not to kill an animal and its child on the same day. Ki hatam b'shnehem. There's the same reason for both of them. Levilti hayot lanu leiv achsari v'lo nerachem. We cannot be cruel and insensitive and heartless in this world. Or shelo yatira katuv la'asot hashchata. We cannot destroy. La'akor hamin. We cannot make any species extinct. Interesting, he says this 800 years ago. Afal pisha hitir hashchita b'minahu. Even though we are allowed to use that species, we're allowed to kill it, we're allowed to eat it in this case, you can't abuse it. V'hinei ha'reg ha'em v'habanim b'yom echad. If you kill the mother and the child on the same day. Or lakech otam be'yot lahem dror la'uf. Or you take those which are free, when they're free to fly away. Ke'ilu yachrit ha'min ha'hu. Very strong words. Ke'ilu yachrit ha'min ha'hu. That little act of extinction, of taking an animal and its child, is a mini extinction, which you're not allowed to do. And if you think about it, the mass extinctions of like the bison over the North American plains that took place really over a very short amount of time could never have happened if people had been keeping this mitzvah. Because if you're going to just randomly kill thousands of animals on one day, how do you know that you're not killing a mother and a child in the same day? There's an interesting discussion to be had here. Hunting wild animals has also never been our thing. Are we allowed to eat wild animals? Sometimes. There are chayot, which we are allowed to eat, but there's a mitzvah. Okay, number 16. Ish ish mibnei Yisrael o min ager agar betocham, asher yetzud tzeyed chaya, okay, or off, asher yachel. If you are going to take a wild animal, not a domesticated animal, and eat it, for example, a wild bird or a wild deer or something like that. Okay, v'shafach et damo v'kisehu ba'afar. You must cover the blood. There's a mitzvah of kisui hadam. You have to cover the blood of that animal, meaning you can't just go around mass slaughtering things, leaving the blood on the ground. Every individual animal has to be thought through, And when that animal is killed, that blood has to be covered again to give you pause for thought as to what exactly is going on here. And in a famous tshuva in the Nodi B'Yehuda, which I'm not going to read inside, he says, in terms of killing animals just for fun, of fox hunting and animal hunting, etc., the only people we find who are hunters in the Tanakh are the people that we don't want to associate with. Esav, Nimrod, etc. He says, I just don't understand why people would even have a hava mina, have any thought that hunting for taiva, for fun, for sport, is in any way allowed, apart from the fact that he says it's dangerous. People get killed all the time. He says, look at the posik when Esav comes in from hunting, and he says, Ani olech lamut, I'm going to die. He says, the pshat of that posik is he's got himself into danger, into trouble hunting. He says, I don't know why people would even think that that was a Jewish thing to do. And even animal, if you say the animals are dangerous, he says, that's not a heter. You can't go around killing animals because you think they're dangerous. Only if those animals present a real threat to human habitation, then you can start thinking about culling those animals. So hunting is off the debate. It's amazing in this day and age that they're still arguing in England right now about whether there should be a debate on fox hunting, yes or no. It's a strange thing. You think, like, we live in a parallel universe where all sorts of strange things are going on. Other things that I just mentioned on this first idea of understanding the man's role in the world, there is, of course, a mitzvah of kilayim, of not mixing those things which shouldn't be mixed, of abusing the boundaries. We talked about that quite a lot when we talked about technology and gene therapy, etc. But there are those mitzvahs as well of kilayim. There's the mitzvah of the migrash. What's the migrash? The cities, the Arei Leviim, the cities of the Levites, okay, there's a mitzvah to leave a green space. In England, they call it a green belt. I don't know what they call it in other places. Around those cities of 1,000 amos and 2,000 amos, that you can't just have a city, an urban sprawl. The city has to have a green space around it. That's one of the mitzvahs in the Torah. And also, I found this beautiful midrash in number 20, which I'd never seen before, on the issue of sustainability. Look at this and see what you make of this in number 20. Kevan sheshema ha'aretz, ha'lashon hazeh. When the world heard this language, peru revu, then the world got worried. Okay, what's going to be if all these people, if there are billions and billions of people in the world? The earth shook. The Amran, they said, lifnei Abor, and said before God, Ribon Alonim, ein li koach lazun sono shel adam. I don't have the koach to sustain lazun, to sustain billions upon billions upon billions of people. I just don't have it, which is an interesting question. So what's God going to do? Amalai Kodesh Baruch Hu. God said to the land, ani va'ata nizun sono shel adam. Let's do it together. I'll take on part, and you take on part. V'chatzu ben shneim, they divided it up between them. Halayla shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, nighttime goes to God, v'hayom la'aretz, and daytime goes to the world. Ma'asa HaKadosh Baruch Hu, what does that mean? Bara shnat chaim, God created the sleep of life. Not sure what shnat chaim exactly is, but sustaining and nourishing sleep. Just by getting a good night's sleep, that will give you almost as much as you need to stay healthy and strong as overeating and overconsuming, etc. So rather than consuming more and eating more, just go to sleep earlier and you'll actually feel just as good the next day. It's a very interesting medrash. Okay? Interesting. I don't exactly know what to make of this medrash, other than to encourage people to have more sleep, better quality sleep, and to eat less, I suppose. I'm not exactly a model for that myself. You know, the Rambam says that 8 hours sleep is a good balance for people at night. He himself probably never got more than 3 or 4. If you look at his memoirs, he was just too busy. And, you know, life is not always as ideally balanced as we like. But there is this idea that eating less, consuming less, and sleeping more is part of this sustainability as well. And Chazal were open to this. So that's the first model. And I think you'll see that there is a lot of sensitivity in that. There are mitzvot, many mitzvot, hashkafic ideas about the balance between man and nature and protecting that. That's the first model. The second model is Bal Tashchit. That's more of a halachic issue. Let's look at it now. Number 21, Ki Tatzur El Ha'ir Yamim Rabim. When you besiege a city, Le'ilachem Aleha, and you're trying to make war against it, Le'tafsa, and you're trying to capture it. Lo tashchit etetza lindoach alav garzen. Don't cut down the trees with an axe. Ki mimena tochel, because the trees are what you're going to eat from. V'ato lo tichot. How can you cut them down?
Ki ha'adam eitz ha'sadeh.
Now this question, is this a question or is this a statement? Ki ha'adam eitz ha'sadeh lavo mipanecha b'matzor. Is a tree, a man a tree that you would involve them in the siege in that way? Why are you treating trees like you treat people? Now, what does that mean? There are a number of approaches to this. Rashi's approach is to say, one second, if human beings are fighting with each other, that's one thing. No one says that's a good thing, but that's a thing. Why are you bringing the environment into your human problems? What's it got to do with the environment? Leave the trees alone. It's nothing to do with them. Look at what he says. Ki ha'adam eitz ha'sadeh, hari ki meshamesh b'loshon dilma. It's a question, he says. Shema ha'adam eitz ha'sadeh likanes b'tocha matzor. Is a tree, is a man and a tree the same thing that you'd involve them in the siege? Mipanecha? Lehityaseb yisurei rav v'tzema? Are you going to make the trees hungry? Are you going to make the trees thirsty? Ka'anshei ha'ir? Lamatashkitana? Why would you destroy them? And the Sifsei Chachamim explains that when one of the things that people did is that when they captured an individual, so they'd torture them and they'd punish them and they'd make them hungry and thirsty and to frighten the other people in the city that they shouldn't join in the war. So you think you're going to do that to the trees? It's going to make any of the trees different? Like, it's got nothing to do with the trees. Leave the trees out of it. Very interesting that in that sense, human beings have to respect that the natural world is not part of their fight. The Ibn Ezra gives a more practical understanding. Number 24, ki ha'adam eitz ha'sadeh, v'hatam ki chai ben adam hu eitz ha'sadeh. Why are you destroying the trees? You're only in the long term damaging yourself. It's an interesting perspective. Ki chai nefesh hu chovel, because you're just damaging your own future sustenance. Hine lo tashchit eitz pri shehu chaim leben adam. Rak mutar shetochal nemenu. You can eat it, you can't destroy it. Va'asor lecha lashchito, kedei shetavo ha'ir mipanecha b'matzor. Just short-term benefit should not overbalance long-term need. And this, of course, raises the fundamental question, which is, there's a balance to be struck here. On the one hand, you're besieging a city. I need these trees. Why do I need these trees? I need these trees because I need to make battering rams and I need to make firewood. I need them for now. Okay, you need them for now, but what about for later? How do the needs of the immediate needs of now balance against the long-term sustainable needs of it? And that's the question that mitzvah is raising. There's a limit that you can't do. At a certain point, you can't destroy things because you don't know what they do. You know, and Chazal actually pointed out here, look at number 25, very light, very beautiful Gemara. I'm a Rav Yehuda, I'm a Rav. Kol ma shebara kadosh baruch hu hubalama lo bara davar echad levatala. Nothing is unneeded. Don't think anything is, oh, well, it doesn't matter. We'll just drop pesticides here and there, and if we destroy that, yeah, beseder. No. Bara shablul. What's a shablul? It's a snail, right? He created snails. Lekatit. Because apparently, you know, if you rub a snail against a saw, I'm not recommending this at home. Go to your doctor for medical advice. That apparently works. Bara zvuv. Letzira. Apparently a fly was a good remedy. If you crush the fly and rub it on a wasp sting, so that would make it better. Yatush, mosquitoes, who needs them? Okay. Lenachash, apparently they're good against snake bites. Nachash, chavafit, against a rash. Usmamit, which is some kind of gecko. Lakrav, against a scorpion skin, meaning a sting. I mean, everything has a purpose. Nothing is unimportant. And our permission to kill different things has to be balanced with the fact that they may be needed in the longer term. And the Rambam actually paskens this in a sense that the balance that he tries to strike in halacha is to create this phrase derech hashchata. Look at what he says on a halachic level in number 27. Ein kotzesin ilanei machal. You cannot cut down trees, fruit trees, trees that give fruit. Okay, shechutz lemedina, outside the town. The ein moni mehem emes amas amayim. You can't take away the water source. Kedei sheivashu, so that they'll dry up. Sheivashu sheneemar lo tashchit etzitza. V'kol hakotzetz loke. This is a Torah mitzvah. If you cut down a fruit tree, he says, that is a Torah prohibition. There's malchus. V'lo b'matzor bilvad. Not only in a siege. Ela b'chol makom, kol hakotzetz ilan machal derech hashchata. If you cut down trees, derech hashchata. What does derech hashchata mean? In a way which is destructive. And he'll say soon it's a balance. Aval kotzetzin oto im haya mazik ilanot achirim. But what if your tree, what if your fig tree is actually poisoning or damaging other trees? Oh, okay, so then you can cut that down. Meaning it's not an absolute. Or mipnei shemazik b'sadeh acharim, or your tree is damaging other people's. It could be your tree is overhanging somebody else's feed, causing damage to that field. So maybe you can cut that down. Okay. Or mipnei shedamav yikarim, or maybe the tree is worth more economically for the wood than it is for the fruit. Okay, so that's also something you could do. So the Rambam actually is opening this to a much more tricky debate, because he's saying that actually economically, if you can justify destroying the tree because the value of the wood is more than the value of the fruit, then maybe that's not called derech hashchata. That's not wanton. There's an immediate need. But that raises then the question, okay, but I need the wood now to sell now because I need the money short term. But think of the long term. How many crops this could give in the long term? How do I weigh those things together? And he says, "V'loha ilanot bilvad, not only trees, ela kolam shaber kelim. If you smash things, the korea begadim or tear clothing, the horeis binyan or smash buildings, the sotem mayan or block up a well or ma'abed machalot or destroy food, derech hashchata or ver belo tashchitz." So that again raises this question, and I don't have a clear answer to this. Where does the short-term economic need then trump the long-term? Trump was not meant to be a pun in any sense. When does that overturn the long-term needs, and that you could say, well, this is not derech hashchata because I need it now? Yes?
I was just thinking the rainforest, that when they cut down the trees there, some of them became extinct, right?
Right. How do you weigh that? There are needs. People need jobs. People need to mine. People need to, etc. Is that called derech hashchata? What you end up having to do is weigh those other hashkafic issues that we saw before and create a hashkafic matrix in which to weigh this halachic question. That's ultimately, and this is perhaps the whole purpose of this whole series that we've been having for the last 75 shirim, to understand how hashkafa creates a background matrix in which halacha can be properly understood. And if you don't have the hashkafic matrix, then the halacha could be potentially abused. So you have this permission to cut down the tree because the value of the tree is good for the wood. But on the other hand, you have the hashkafic needs.
And you have renewal. You cut it down, planting new at the same time, cutting it down.
Right. How do you weigh the renewal against that? These are going to be difficulties that you're going to have to come, you know, to grips with. There are those who want to say that cutting down the trees may be an unusually severe thing in and of itself. There's an interesting Gemara. Rabbi Chanina says in number 28, Lo Shachiv Shivtchat, that was the name of his son, Bari, my son, died. He felt early. The reason he died, Ela Dekatz Teinta Beloizmana, because he felt he died early because he cut down a fig tree before it should have been cut down. And Rabbi Yaakov Emden says, I don't understand. Why would he have died because he cut a fig tree down? If it's osser, it's osser. Why are you bringing in the danger? And he says that it could be that in this particular case, and Rabbi Huda Achosid says a similar thing, that actually maybe even cutting down trees has an objective, maybe even Kabbalistic problem. That even if it's mutar, even if it's allowed technically, halachically, people are very nervous about cutting down trees. And people are, by the way. If you ever had a fruit tree that's causing a problem and, you know, you say to your neighbors, you know, please can you deal with your tree? People get all, you know, mystical and Kabbalistic and unhappy about those kind of things. I don't know if anyone's ever had any neighborly disputes dealing with trees. But we do take this very seriously. There's a mitzvah to daven for a tree. You ever daven for a tree? Nebuch, you see a tree. Look in number 30. Ilan shemeshir perutav, nebuch, a fruit tree is dropping its fruit. It's like miscarrying its fruit. So kobesikra, you have to paint it red. Put a red blob on the tree. So the Gemara says, so kobesikra, my rufu akavid. What does putting a red blob on the tree do for the tree? I mean, that doesn't help the fruit. So he says, no, but it tells people that the tree needs tefillah. Ki heicha delichazi inshi. Okay, when people see the tree, okay, Rubau Alea, Rachamim, they will ask for Rachamim. They will daven for the tree. Kedatania Tame Tame Yikra. Who says Tame Tame? The Metzora. So why does he say it twice? Well, because Jewish people say everything twice. Kuchavas, Kuchavas. Okay? Tame Tame. So the first Tame is keep away, because you don't want to get too close to me because I could affect your Tumah and Tara. But the second Tame is please daven for me. You have to tell other people. People will daven for that person. So too the tree. See this nice connection again between the tree and the Metzora? Just like there are people in distress, there are trees in distress. And therefore, maybe on Tu B'Shvat, it's a nice time to daven for a tree. If you see in Nebuch a tree looking sad, maybe you can include that tree. I don't know what you call it. Something ben something or bat something, whatever. Now, you wouldn't really do that, but you could. I'm actually joking, but it's a serious thing. People daven on Tu B'Shvat for a good esrog, which is a kind of minhag. People daven. That's nice, and you should do that. But you can also daven for the tree itself. The Sefer HaChinuch says the hallmark of a chassid, someone who wants to do good, is someone who wants to protect even the smallest seed in the world, which is afilu gargar shel chardal ba'olam. That's a good person, a chassid. A good person is someone who wants to protect everything and not destroy anything. And there's a quite a famous Gemara, number 32, Amar Rabbi Simon, Ein lecha kol esev esev, every blade of grass in the world, she'ein lo mazal berikia she'makauto. There's something strange going on here. With a bit of interference. I blame the trees personally, but no. They'll sort that out. There's no blade of grass in the world that doesn't have some kind of malach that is hitting it, the omelon saying it to him, get up, grow. Okay? And it brings a posse, did you just go and report the technology issue? Okay, thank you. Every blade of grass has something, has a malach, which is, if you like, instructing it, you have a special place in this world. There's this quite a famous story. Rav Cook was walking with Rav Aryeh Levine, and Rav Aryeh Levine just, you know, without thinking, schlepped a leaf off a tree as they were walking together, and Rav Cook turned around to him and said, what are you doing? What are you thinking? Why did you do that? And he said, why did I do what? He said, you just schlepped a leaf off a tree for no reason. There was a malach, if you like, telling that leaf grow, and now you just destroy that. You know, that's a baal tashkis on a certain level. Obviously, that's a very high level. But nevertheless, it's something we need to be conscious of. The Gemara says, don't turn on the lights if you don't need them, because it wastes fuel. Okay? Don't, the Gemara says in Shabbos, don't Amamar Azutra, Haiman de Michsi Shraga, de Mashcha Umagri Nafta, if you cover up the candle in such a way that it burns more fuel than it needs to, Ka'ava Mishum Baal Tashkis. Baal Tashchis. Why are you leaving the lights on when you don't need them on? Interesting. Now, I'm not telling you you have to turn every light off, otherwise you're doing an Issa, you know, like, but it's some, maybe you are, maybe that is an issue. Where does Baal Tashchis begin and where does it end? If you take too much food at the buffet and you're going to leave half of it at the end, is that Baal Tashchis or is that not Baal Tashchis? How does that work? On the other hand, there's an economic debate. Some people will say, well, all this food that goes to waste at the end of a simcha, isn't that Baal Tashchis? So maybe, but the question is, if it's going to cost me more to bring people in to take the food away, then maybe that's not Baal Tashchis, meaning I don't have to save the food if the economic cost of saving the food outweighs the cost of the food, and that becomes a difficult cheshbon. Now nowadays there are gemachs that will come and take your food and bring it to other people, but it's not so posh because not everybody wants old food, and there's some things you can give and some things you can't give, etc. But that is, it's a consideration as to how we use fuel and when it is right and when it isn't right. Sometimes it's not Baal Tashchis because you want to make a nice, you know, spread, because making a nice spread is part of the simcha. Sometimes it is Baal Tashchis. Look at these two pieces from Rav Hirsch, 34 and 35. Under the concept of Baal Tashchis, the purposeless destruction of anything at all is taken to be forbidden. So that the Loi Tashchis of our text becomes the most comprehensive warning. Oh, I put warming here. That's actually it's another Freudian slip there. Warning to human beings not to misuse the position which God has given them as masters of the world and its matter to capricious, passionate, or merely thoughtless, wasteful destruction of anything on earth. Only for wise use has God laid the world at our feet when he says to man, subdue the world and have dominion over it. And he says it even more harshly in Chorev. Chorev is an amazing read. Everyone should really read Chorev. Chorev, which of course was Rav Hirsch's first main work. He produced Chorev in the 1830s, a very big work on his Tamei Mitzvot, his understanding of the reasons for Mitzvot. He couldn't find anyone to publish it because the publishers were nervous. Who's going to buy this? Who's going to read this very, you know, thick work on Tamei Mitzvot? So they said to him, why not put out a market tester? Write a little book, see if anybody likes it, and if they like that, then we'll put out the bigger book. You know, market forces have always been an issue. So then he wrote the 19 letters. The famous 19 letters of Rav Hirsch, he wrote that as a market teaser, tester, to see if people, and it sold out. So then the publisher said, okay, good, now we'll publish Chorev. So he says in Chorev the following, number 35. Be a man, he says, only if you use the things around you for wise human purposes, sanctified by the word of my teaching, only then are you a man, and have the right over them which I've given you as a man. However, if you destroy, if you ruin, At that moment, you are not a man. You are an animal. And you have no right to the things around you. I lend them to you for wise use only. Never forget that I lent them to you. As soon as you use them unwisely, be it the greatest or the smallest, you commit treachery against my world. You commit murder and robbery against my property, and you sin against me. That's pretty strong. A bit difficult to argue that there's no environmental consciousness in rabbinic literature. When Rav Hirsch was saying this kind of thing, 150 years before anyone thought of the word environmentalism. Now, again, I'm not trying to tell you that the rabbis were eco-friendly. I'm trying to tell you that this is a very main theme, a mainstream theme in our literature. And on this, finally, on this particular point, the story of Chayni HaMagal. Let's look at Chayni HaMagal number 636. Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Kol yamav shel oisa tzadik haya mitzdar al mikra. The Chayni HaMagal was always, or there was a tzadik who was always concerned. What does the posik mean? Shashir amalos b'shuv Hashem eshivat tzion ayinu kacholmim. That we were dreaming for 70 years, we were dreaming, we came back to Israel after Galut, and it turned out we were dreamers. Amar, he said, Mi'ika dinim shivim shanim b'chamma. Is there anyone who will sleep for 70 years in a dream? So the Gemara answers, Yum achad hava azel b'urcha. Then he was going along the road, this person. Chazila hahu gavra de hava nata charuva. He was planting a carob tree. Amale, he said to him, Hi ad kama shanim time. How long does it take for this carob tree to become fruitful? Amalei said to him, At shivim shanim, shivim shnin, 70 years. Amalei said to him, Pshita lecha dechayit shivim shnin? Are you confident you're going to live 70 years and reap the fruit from this tree? So Amalei, he said to him, Hai gavra alma b'charuva ashkhite. When I came into this world, I found carob trees that had been planted for me. Ki heichi d'shasli li avatai, just like my ancestors planted for me, Shakli nami librai. I'll plant for my children as well. And the idea of having a long-term focus is clearly very central as well. So that's the second model, Bal Tashchit. I hope you'll see there that it's a very broad model. It has applications across the board. The last model I want to talk about for just the last 10 minutes of the shir is a more specific issue of Hilchas Shcheinim. We do not have unfettered rights to do whatever we like on our own property. That is enshrined in Halakha. Look, for example, in number 37. Lo yiftach adam chanut shel nachtoimim. You can't open a bakery shop, v'shel tzva'im, or a dyeing shop, tachat oitzro shel chavero. Underneath is someone else's machsam. If someone else has a food storage facility, and you open something which is very smelly and very hot underneath it, then that's going to affect their food. V'lo refet bakar. And you can't open up a refet. Anyone who has a refet close to them will know that sometimes has unwanted effects. Be'emes, he says, really, the Mishnah says, Be'yayin hetiru. With wine, we're not so bothered. Avaloi berefet bakar, but even with wine storage, a refet is going to destroy your wine. Chanut shebechatzer. If someone wants to open a shop in your little chatzer, yacholim chot biyado. You can say to them, hang on, I don't want a shop here. V'loi malan, you can say to them, Eini yochel lishon mikol ha-nichnasim. Or mikol ha-yotzim. I can't go to sleep now at night because you've opened a shop and people are coming in all day and night. Someone wants to open a clothes shop. And, it's open all day and all night. And well, it's 11 o'clock at night. People are slamming doors and you're all nodding. I see a lot of people nodding here that there's this is something that you can't do that. I say kelim yotze u'moiche b'toich ha-shuk. Aval ein yochel limchot. And there's all sorts of different areas. Can people object? Can't people object? If someone opens a school, says the Mishnah, you can't object. Because the interests of chinuch yeladim overrides your personal concerns. Meaning if someone wants to open a cheder and there are kids screaming and shouting all through the day and you can't sleep in the afternoon, so maybe the answer is you have to move. Maybe. Meaning it's a balance. You can't just turn around and say nobody else can do anything because it disturbs or upsets me. On the other hand, there are lines that have to be drawn. So too with public nuisance. Look in 38, a mission in Bava Metzia. Ein shorim tit brushus arabim. You can't soak cement. You can't make cement in the middle of the road. Ve'ein loivnim levenim. And you can't bake bricks. You can't just say, well, I don't know, I have a brick baking business. Where am I going to do it? I'm not going to do it in my bathroom, am I? I'm going to do it in the street. The answer is, well, no, you can't do that. Aval goivlim tit. But you can mix cement. You can knead the cement, brushus arabim, in the street. That you can do. That's okay. That's reasonable. Aval loy levenim, but not bricks. Meaning, the Gemara, again, the Mishnah is trying to draw lines. This, you have to be able to conduct your own commercial business. Obviously you do. but you can't cross certain lines. Look at this fascinating discussion in number 39. Rav Yosef Haveli Hanhutalai. Rav Yosef had a bunch of trees, some small date palms. Dehava Asa Umni, and blood letters, people who worked in blood, they used to let people's blood quite a lot back in the day. I'm not getting into why they did that, but they used to feel it was quite helpful. So there was like a clinic, let's call it, underneath his date palms where blood letters would come and practice. The Yasvitas Fayan, they used to sit and do their blood letting underneath. So what happens? There's now blood dripping on the floor. The Asu Orve, and crows now would come. The Achlidama, to eat the blood. The Salki, Abe Tali, Umafsidi Tamri, and then they'd go up into the date palms and they'd destroy the dates. So he turned around and said, your business has an unwanted side effect. There are now crows all over the place and they're ruining my dates. You've got to stop these people from doing it. Amar Lahu Rav Yosef. So Rav Yosef said, Afikuli karkur mihacha. Get rid of your karkur. Kurkur. Kur. I don't know if it's a modern Hebrew word, but kurkur is obviously a word for a crow. Because it's an onomatopoeic word. Yeah, kurkur. Yeah, so he says, get your, it's like back book. It's the same kind of thing. So get your crows out of my trees. So Amalei Abaya, so Abaya said to him, Vahagromahu. I'm sorry, this is an indirect damage. It's groma, meaning I'm not bringing crows. There's a bloodletting business. There's a clinic under there, and the crows are coming because of the clinic, and the crows are damaging your trees. It's not my fault. So Amalei responds to him, I'm sorry, that's not an excuse. Hachi Amarov Tuvi Bar Masna, Zot Omeret Groma Benizikin Osir. Now this is a whole big debate, which I'm not getting into now. Maybe we can have a few shirim on momentous issues. But is indirect damage, which is caused to somebody else's economic concern, is that also allowed or is that not allowed? Is it potter? Is it osir? Etc. etc. So he wants to argue that actually, if you indirectly damage my dates, that's also osir. The ha'achzik lehu. Oh, so the Gemara now comes and says, but he gave permission. These people who were doing the blood, the clinic underneath the trees, they rented out the place with permission. They didn't just squat there. He'd allowed that. The hamar Rav Nachman amarabba bar avua ein chazokel nizokin. Oh, but that doesn't matter because even if you gave permission, maybe it was worse than you thought. The la'it ma'alai. Didn't they say about this Rav Meri amar bekutra when it comes to smoke? For Rav Zvid Amar Bebesakise, if someone's going to have a bathroom, okay, then even if you gave them permission, when you find out how bad it really is, you can close them down. So Abai says to him, yeah, but that's for smoke and that's for a bathroom. So Amalei said to him, honey, these things, these guys, Lilidi, for me, Dainina Daisi, I'm very sensitive, Kikutru Besakise Dabal. They're like a bathroom for me. I can't have these crows on my trees, get rid of the crows. And therefore this, again, this balance between, on the one hand, well, come on, you gave me permission, and on the other hand, yeah, but I never realized how bad it was going to be. If I'd have known that this was going to happen to my environment by having this business here, I would never have allowed it. Okay, so let's take it away. Look at number 41 for a second. This is a tshuva. I only found this in English. I couldn't find it in Hebrew, but I brought this for you from Salonika in the 17th century. The question you've addressed to me concerning the butchers who have bought from the neighbors the right to build an abattoir has reached me. So this was a group of butchers who bought, you know, legally, taken out a rental on a nearby building, and they've created an abattoir. I understand that the butchers have already established an abattoir and have commenced to operate it, he says. At the outset, it would seem that because they've purchased this right from the neighbors have given their consent to its construction and may not be allowed to retract their consent. However, we see that all the authorities argue that with regards to damages of smoke and bad odor, we saw that before, a person is not really able to bear them, and therefore we may suppose that even if one agreed at the beginning, we may not see this as a foregoing their rights in the future. They agreed at the outset since they thought they would be able to live with the damage. However, now that they see and smell it in practice, they see that they cannot do so. Even if, as in our case, they actually sold the right, they may retract their consent, and therefore the abattoirs have to be closed. Very interesting. He was prepared to close down a business because people, even though they'd given permission for that, didn't realize quite how bad that was going to be. And how does this translate into our discussion in terms of the environment? Nowadays, you can have a business which pollutes not just the neighbors, but can pollute water for hundreds of thousands of people, or air quality for millions and millions of people. How are we going to work Hilcha Shchenim into the modern day environmental discussion? Because it has to be worked in somehow. And the question is, do we have at our disposal in the classic based-in structure, which was really designed for neighbor disputes, the ability to translate this into a big picture? If we had today an Israeli legal system which was bound by halakha and hashkafa, how would this impact on that? Very interesting, almost like a mishpat ivri kind of question. Do you bring in these halachic issues? And let's just finish just on the last particular issue with the underlying question behind this, the underlying idea behind this. Have a look, look at the last source in number 43 for a second. We'll finish with this, and then we'll summarize what we've said. The Rosh explains what's going on with these neighborly issues. And he brings in a beautiful idea which we need to actually think about. Hamadagdig beperik lo yachpor. If you look carefully at this perik which deals with what you can and can't do, deshiru chachamim b'chol davar v'davar. The rabbis try to work out on each individual issue. Lefimashe roi lahazik. You can damage this much, but now you have to stop. This is okay. This is already crossing a line. V'heicha shiyadua k'tzav v'ksakum v'schum. Where they know that there was a fixed amount, they were able to write a shiur. And sometimes they left it a bit vague and said, it was so you don't damage. But we don't know exactly what that line is. And he gives a reason. Very important pasuk. Because we have to be able to live b'darchei Noam. We have to live in an environment of no'am, of ni'ima, ni'imutz, and shalom. And that's not just a nice idea. That's a halachic principle. You are behaving on your property in a way which is not, it's not na'ya, it's not beseder, it's not darchei no'am. V'hikpida Torah shelo yase adam b'toch shelo, dava hagorem hezik lechavero. So, for all of these reasons, and I don't know exactly where this leaves us in terms of Lamaisa. Should we all be going out tomorrow and signing up for environmental this and green that? No, I don't think so necessarily, because there are other issues. And by the way, I didn't even get into the reality of the fact that the green lobby out there also tends to go along with other perspectives and views which we don't feel comfortable with. There's a whole anti-Israel sort of approach that we find in that, even maybe an anti-Semitic sometimes. I'm not tarring everybody with the same brush, but it's a reality and we can't ignore it, and therefore signing up for a certain way of thinking also brings with it other unwanted side effects. But nevertheless, I think we've seen, whether it's because of the general balance of mankind in nature or Baal Tashchis, which is a very critical halakhic area, or this issue of neighborly disputes, we do have to take this seriously. This is a real Jewish issue. This is not a mishigas. This is something that we have to focus on and take a Jewish view on. And again, we need to think about what that means as a society, as individuals, whether we do recycle, don't recycle, do turn off the lights, don't turn off the lights. At least we have to think about it and take it from there. So I think that will hopefully be enough for one session. Next Wednesday, please God, I want to go on to, as I said, a new topic, a new series on technology, science, because we haven't really spoke about that and we really must. Okay, have a great week and we'll see you soon.